From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Daniel Mark Epstein is my guest. He is a renowned poet, playwright, and biographer. His subjects have included President Lincoln and Amy Semple McPherson. A few years ago, he wrote a superb biography of Nat King Cole. His latest book is The Ballad of Bob Dylan, A Portrait. Daniel Mark Epstein, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's great to be here with you, Gary.
I enjoyed your book very much. You know, like Lincoln, I guess, Bob Dylan has really been written about a lot. But your new book, The Ballad of Bob Dylan, I think it's the first that has the benefit of being able to draw from Dylan's own book, Chronicles, Volume 1, and from Susie Rotolo's book, A Free Will and Time. Is that what kind of pushed you finally to write about Dylan? Because obviously you've been a fan for a long time.
Well, for me, it's really been a kind of a dream subject because Bob Dylan was a huge influence on me as a poet and as a writer from the time I was a kid. Because I first heard him in 1963 when I was 14. And so as a biographer, I've always been interested in, you know, the most fascinating people that I could possibly write about, as you can tell from that list of very various subjects, Amy Semple McPherson, Nat King Cole, Ed and St. Vincent Millay, Abraham Lincoln. I've always been attracted to subjects that had charisma, and Bob Dylan really has that. So it wasn't so much the books that you referred to, although it's that actually introduces a very interesting subject in terms of talking about writing biography. It was the fact that I was fascinated by Dylan from a very young age. I felt a kind of identification with him as a poet and as a folk musician when I was a kid. It was that that first drew me to the subject.
What is it about writing biography that relates to the coming of Chronicles and Susie Rotolo?
The fact is that a biographer is really no better than their sources. And if you're lucky enough to have some direct connection with the subject, as I've had, in being able, you know, being an eyewitness to his concerts, knowing a lot of the same people that he knew, and so on, that's a great thing. But your most important sources, unless you know the person personally, are going to be other biographers. They're going to be people who knew him and were close to him. And the fact is, you know, my book is the first book about Bob Dylan in about 11 years, and some incredible sources have emerged since then, one of which is Dylan's own Chronicles, which is a very, very transparent, ingenuous, and revealing biography, autobiography. Then there's Susie Rotolo's book. Susie Rotolo, who was his girlfriend when he was...
She's the one on the cover of Free Will and Bob Dylan.
Yes, and that wonderful photograph of them walking in the cold and through the streets of New York City. And then the autobiography of Dave Van Ronk, who was, they called him the mayor of McDougal Street, and he was an incredible blues musician who was the very center of the folk music revival when Dylan arrived in New York in the early 60s. So there are all these books that didn't exist. They weren't. It wasn't possible for a biographer to draw on them before my book. So I think I have been able to bring a kind of intelligence to the book that was not possible before because of these, you know, standing on the shoulders of these other writers.
There's also been, and you didn't mention it in your book, but there was the film that Bob made, which was later directed by Martin Scorsese, although I think the things that Bob did for it were done before Scorsese got involved, but I'm not sure. That's the movie called No Direction Home, where Dylan speaks pretty openly about... Have you seen the film? I'm sure you have.
I have, yeah.
And
I can't say I learned a great deal from it.
No.
I think, you know, most of the information that was in that film was stuff that was already available to me from other sources.
Uh-huh.
Still a great film.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's great to see Dylan, you know, being interviewed on camera. He's actually being interviewed by his manager, Jeff Rosen,
oh.
one of the few people who has that sort of access to Dylan, who could make Bob Dylan feel comfortable and ask him some hard questions.
Now, you didn't actually get to meet him, though. I mean, you tell a story where you came close to meeting him, but he didn't come to the meeting or something like that.
Yes, in the early 1980s, I was working as a playwright, writing plays for the Public Theater in New York City, the mm-hmm. New York Shakespeare Festival. And at that time, Dylan's career was kind of in decline. He had entered his born-again phase and was writing mostly gospel music. And had decided at that point that he really didn't want to perform his old songs anymore, the great songs, the protest songs of the 60s, the great rock music of the late 60s and early 70s, that he was only going to perform the religious music. So he and his manager got the idea that they wanted to have a Broadway musical that would showcase all of these great songs, like The Times They Are Changing and Blowing in the Wind and so on, that would showcase these songs that supposedly he would never sing again. So I was actually called into his office with a number of other dramatists to try to give them ideas about how to put together such a musical.
You know, I want to talk about the Christian period for a minute, because in the book you say that's where you kind of lost track of Bob. You stopped listening for a while, and you were very put off by his conversion to Christianity. And I think primarily you said because you didn't like the music that he was writing then. But I wonder, why did it bother you? I mean, Abraham Lincoln, I believe, is a Christian, and you wrote about him. And why did it bother you particularly that Bob became a Christian?
Well, actually, Abraham Lincoln was an agnostic.
Okay.
There's really, we could talk about that for an entire show, but we won't. The fact is, Abraham Lincoln he never avowed that he was really a Christian. And actually, what I say in my book, it's not so much that Bob Dylan became a Christian; it's that his thoughts and his music and even his performances became dominated by this ideology of Christianity, and he was actually preaching from the stage. All of his songs were basically preaching that Christianity was the only way. I mean, it was a very strict kind of fundamentalist Christianity that he was propounding both in his songs and his performances. And that kind of put me off. At that point in my life, I was not, as I say in the book, I was not willing to be preached to by Bob Dylan or anybody else, even though I loved Bob's music. And I actually like a lot of songs that he did during that period, Grains of Sand, and I mean, there were lots of incredible songs that he wrote during that period. But to me, I had always thought that Bob Dylan had, you know, as T.S. Eliot said of Henry James, a mind so fine that no idea could violate it. Dylan seemed to me to have that kind of intelligence as a poet and even as a political thinker, although he was not, you know, he certainly was not all that sophisticated in terms of his political thought. He seemed to me to be a man who always went his own way, who had his own way of thinking about the world, and would not preach to anybody else. Christianity took over his consciousness in a way that nothing else ever did. And anyway, I found that...
It was definitely a weird period. There's no two ways about it. And it didn't seem to really last very long, because... Although, as you were saying, he said he would never sing those songs again. About a year later, he started slowly integrating them into his show, although he would change some of the lyrics subtly so that, you know, Simple Twist of Fate became a Christian song and so forth.
Right, right.
Dylan is an oddball, I guess, as you must know since you wrote about him. And we're talking with Daniel Mark Epstein, and his new book is a biography of Bob Dylan. It's called The Ballad of Bob Dylan. It's really interesting and fun to read. I was in New York when I was reading it, so it was even better. Now, I think one of the things that's kind of a revelation in your book is the famous motorcycle accident of 1967.
Well, I think that that part of his life is very interesting, because here's a man who's been famous since he was 20 years old, you know, from the time that he started singing folk music in coffee houses in Greenwich Village. He was taken up by the press, by the New York Times. He was sort of became the crown prince of folk music, and, you know, celebrated at the New York, you know, the Newport Folk Festival, and he was entirely dominant in that in that part of the world. And then suddenly turned his back on that and went his own way in a way that very few artists would. And he became a rock star, and felt all of the pressures that one feels as a rock star in America and in Europe, you know, having to tour constantly, having to take drugs sometimes to stay awake or to go to sleep. It was too much for him. And so he did a really unprecedented thing, you know, really before the life of the rock star completely ruined him. In 1965, he had this so-called motorcycle accident. I was able to find out from a number of interviews on and off the record that it wasn't really such a bad, you know, bad accident. He was living in Woodstock. He was very tired the night that, the morning that he wanted to go and ride the motorcycle. The motorcycle was, the tires weren't filled up, so he went with his wife to the garage to move the motorcycles and the particular motorcycle and have it have the tires pumped up. And as he was walking the motorbike down the road, it fell over on him. This was a perfect opportunity for Bob Dylan, who was off the road for the time being, to stay off the road. He declared that he'd had a horrible, you know, horrible accident. He was injured. He wasn't really hurt. But he did need to retire. He needed to be off the road in order to preserve that very, very delicate balance that all creative people have. In order to continue to write great songs, great poems, he couldn't be a rock star during that period. And so he basically took himself out of the limelight, took himself out of the game for about eight years, and wrote beautiful music while he was doing that. But he wasn't subjected to the pressures of touring during that time.
Was it also an attempt to get away from his management and free himself from that situation too?
Well, I think that his desire for fame and his desire to succeed and make money was really it was met by a management and, you know, by a world that was eager to take him up. So you can't really blame it on the management. You know, I think that Bob Dylan chose Albert Grossman, who was an incredibly skillful manager. Very hard-nosed and tough, realized the realities of the business and the fact that you have to make hay while the sun shines. And so Dylan, you know, he played into that. So I can't really blame it on the management. It's not like he was fleeing that. I think he was really retreating from a situation that he had created himself. One of the fascinating things about Bob Dylan that people ask me, well, what did you learn about this man in writing this biography? You know, what's really been the most interesting thing that you learned about Bob Dylan? And the thing that I learned about Bob Dylan is that he has been, from the very beginning of his life, the master of his fate and the captain of his soul, and a man who set out to achieve certain things, fame, fortune. He wanted to, you know, he wanted to create great art, but he also wanted to reach a lot of people and make a lot of money. And he did that, and he paid the price for it. And the difficulties he's had, he's never blamed on anybody else.
You do a really great job of analyzing Dylan's lyrics in your book. I guess that's the poet in you. But what do you think when you hear him completely remake a song, like a song, say, Tangled Up in Blue? There's three really distinct versions of that. Have you ever tried to reconcile all those versions and find out what the story is with a song like that?
Well, that song is really, you know, Gary, you really you've suggested a work that's it's really postmodern in that, and you know, it tells a story about a man who, you know, falls in love with a woman, and he's not able to he's not able to marry her at first, and later he does, and then later he's separated from her. But he tells the story in so many different ways, even within the original version of the song. There's a kind of dislocation of the narrative where he introduces them after they're married and then before they're married, and the chronology is all jumbled up, which is why the title is Tangled Up in Blue.
Right.
But it works. You know, it's a story that works. It's kind of like one of those novels that you can, you can shuffle the chapters and it still works. It's an extraordinary story. The first time he tells it, it's a story, it's a secular story,
mm-hmm.
About a man who falls in love with a woman, and then they're going through all of the phases that one goes through in a secular relationship. He completely rewrote the song when he became a Christian, and substitutes Christian symbolism into the story. And it doesn't really change the narrative that much, but it changes the tone of it and a lot of the themes.
It kind of has a completely different. It's the later version. I'm thinking of the one that he recorded on that album. I think it's in about 1984, 85. It's a live album with Mick Taylor in the band. Do you know which one I'm talking about? In which he sings that lyric about, I got the worst taste in my mouth that I ever knew, tangled up in blue. Do you know that version?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It becomes more bitter.
Definitely.
If you listen to some of the performances, during the Rolling Thunder review, not the first part of the review, but the second part of the review in the 1976.
Uh-huh.
Sarah's actually in the audience, and the marriage is falling apart. And you know, the song originally was about, you know, his relationship with his wife Sarah, you know, the mother of his children.
Mm-hmm.
And as he's performing this song, and the marriage is falling apart, you can just see the vituperation and the anger and the resentment in him as he performs it. And, I think that eventually affected the lyrics.
Yeah, it's interesting how, and you kind of answered a question for me in your book, and many, I must say, but with this particular one, why the Hard Rain album is so different from the songs he records in, say, Ronaldo and Clara that were subsequently released on one of the Bootleg Sessions records. The tone of the Rolling Thunder review by the time he came to do the television special is completely different.
Yeah, he's really he's acting out, the disaster, the tragedy of his marriage, on stage. I mean, it's really it's incredible theater. The little bit of footage that I've seen.
You know, I want to ask you about the album, Tangled Up in Blue comes from Blood on the Tracks. Right before the album was going to be released, he re-recorded five of the tracks, and abandoned one of them entirely. That was Up to Me. Why do you think he did that?
Well, Dylan is always trying, he's always trying to capture an authenticity in the recording process. He wants the tracks to represent his real feeling in the moment that he's recording them. And as I understand the story, and actually at least one book written about this, so I'm not the ultimate authority on it. Dylan was dissatisfied with the recordings that had been made in the New York studio, and at that time he was having kind of reconciliation with his brother David. They'd had their difficulties over the years, and David Zimmerman was working as a producer back in Minnesota. And David listened to the album and he said, "You know what? This doesn't really ring true. It doesn't really. I don't think it. It sounds technically okay, but I don't think it really represents the feelings that you're having, you know, about your marriage and about what's going on in your life, why don't you come back to Minnesota and we're going to try this here. And so he did.
Hmm.
He did. And Dylan, you know, Dylan is very instinctive about the way he follows his own, you know, as I said, follows his own drummer. And this is a point where he's talking to his brother and he's thinking, you know, this is an opportunity. It's a very personal album. Maybe I really should try this back in Minnesota. And so he did. And so we ended up with the album that most of us hear. Now, there's a lot of controversy. There's some people who believe that that album that, you know, became the commercial album is not as good as what originally was done in New York.
Well, it's almost like those two versions of Idiot Wind could sit side by side on the same record. They're so different.
Yeah.
One being that sort of slow acoustic with that kind of haunting organ part in the back. And then the rocker that he does, that he really rocks out on Hard Rain later. You use Dylan's performances in your book, Bob Dylan, The Ballad of Bob Dylan. We're talking with the author, Daniel Mark Epstein, everybody should know. You used Dylan performances as kind of the takeoff points in your book. And so I want to talk about kind of the latter-day performances of the last, you know, 6 or 7 years. I was talking to Robert Hilburn about this not too long ago, and I suggested that maybe it was time for Bob Dylan to retire from live performing. And Hilburn said, oh, no, because even though the performances might not be top-notch, there's always the chance that they will be. I'm not sure. What do you think?
Well, I tried to reflect all of my feelings that I had when I heard him in 2009. And that was a pretty good show, actually. I think that, you know, when I heard Dylan in 2009, he probably still had, oh, 5 notes of his vocal range. And you can, you know, a blues singer can get by with 5 notes.
Yeah.
And you know, Dylan was... You know, he was husbanding those notes. I mean, he was a lot of his performance was what the Germans refer to as talk singing. You know, which is basically it's speaking the lines in the rhythm over the music. But now and then he would actually sing an entire passage, and when he was on, it was really incredibly moving.
Mm-hmm.
And even when he wasn't on, you the mind is at work there. And when you see Dylan live, it's not just what you're hearing; it's what you're seeing and things that are going on between the lines. So I found that performance very moving. On the other hand, when I hear him sing, you know, when I heard him sing at that performance. And every now and then I'll tune into YouTube to see, like, what he did last week.
Right.
He's performing in Israel, or he's performing in Germany, and there'll be a YouTube. Somebody's got a camera held up, and they're recording what he's doing. And it really pains me. It hurts me to listen to him singing because I feel that, knowing what little I know about singing, it probably is hurting him to sing.
Hmm.
It's got to be painful to do what he's doing. So I don't really agree with Robert, although, you know, I probably would agree with him about just about everything else. I mean, what a wonderful thing it's been for him to interview Dylan so many times.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine Dylan getting more strength in his voice. Or finding another way to communicate those songs. I think as long as he's comfortable doing it, as long as people are going to show up, I'm sure he'll continue to do it. And God bless him. You know, I mean, he certainly earned the right to perform. But he has so many other gifts. He's a great writer. He's a great poet. He's got this new contract to write more autobiography. He's a terrific prose writer.
Oh yeah,
I'd like to see him do that. That could be a whole dimension of his career.
I'm sure Chronicles Volume 3 will be the next one.
We haven't had 2 yet.
Right, exactly. You know. We'll see. But I loved Chronicles. I thought it was so great. I thought there was like a little surprise on every page of Chronicles.
Yes. Yeah, it's a beautiful book. And I've often wondered about the process of writing that. I was able to get, for my own book, I got a great interview with Larry Campbell,
mm-hmm.
who was Dylan's guitarist in the late 90s and early part of the century. And Campbell was in the very privileged position of being a first reader of some of the pages of Dylan's Chronicles.
Yeah.
But what a beautiful book. And he's a great prose stylist, and I think he could have a very interesting career writing prose.
Yeah, you think he could write a novel, tell a story, write a mystery? I don't know. A Western?
I don't know about that, but I think if he just talked about his own life in the way that he did in Chronicles, I'd read the next book.
Yeah. Well, he's a young man. He's only 70.
Well,
you know, I mean, it's true. I mean, it's when I saw the first time I ever saw Frank Sinatra live, I thought, oh, you know, he's really old. But he was, you know, far younger than Bob is now. You know, and he went on for another 20 years.
Yeah, I think Frank Sinatra had an even harder life than Dylan's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I describe Dylan at the end of my book as an elegantly designed machine that has not always been maintained properly. And, you know, I think Dylan is one of the most fascinating things about him to me is that this is a guy who has been in the limelight. He has been, you know, working with, you know, unparalleled energy and force, you know, for 50 years. And has managed, managed to create music, to change, to grow for 50 years. And there are just very few artists I know of who could do that. And I think of Frank Sinatra as being, you know, an extraordinary, extraordinary singer, a great actor, and so on. But I don't think he got quite as much mileage out of his career as Dylan has in terms of years. It would be kind of silly to compare the two careers.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's some similarity between them, I think, in that both of them, I think every singer who came after Sinatra was influenced by Sinatra, and I think every singer who came after Dylan was influenced by Dylan.
That's certainly true. Well, when I interviewed Mike Seeger, my book, by the way, is dedicated to Mike Seeger, who's a very good friend of mine and huge influence on Bob Dylan. Mike and I were talking about the fact that people are always saying Dylan can't sing. Well,
yeah.
Of course, it's mostly people who don't
listen to him.
who don't listen to him or have listened to him once and, you know, didn't really get it, saying that Dylan can't sing. And Mike said to me, well, you know, if Dylan can't sing, why is it that there's so many people who sing like him or try to sing like him or have been influenced by him?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's the question that needs to be posed to anybody who doesn't understand why this man's voice has been so important.
Well, the book is called The Ballad of Bob Dylan, A Portrait, and the author is Daniel Mark Epstein. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank Daniel Mark Epstein and his book, The Ballad of Bob Dylan, for being on the show this week. And I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.